This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good morning. First of all, I would like to thank Chris Owens and all the organizers of the symposium for inviting me here and giving me the chance to present to you all a little bit of our experience with chronic type B dissection and how we approach it. So these are my disclosures. So as a Canadian, I can tell you I can never think of starting a dissection talk without talking about Sir William Osler, who really coined the term the great masquerader to aortic dissection. It's really, there's no other entity that can really involve every single organ or limb in the body. When I look at chronic dissection, I think it's pretty much the most challenging pathology for us aortic surgeons to deal with. TVAR is frequently only the initial procedure, and further interventions are quite often required. And I would say that patience and persistence are really of the utmost importance. I have just two very simple objectives, and I think having clear objective is essential in certain situations. But first is to understand the complexity of treating patients with chronic aortic dissection, and then to explore the surgical options to treat patients with chronic dissection. There are three main indications. Rupture is one. This is a patient of mine with a ruptured aortic dissection with hemothorax. We did a TVAR and delayed VAT, and he did great with that. I'd say that the most common is really aneurysm expansion, and usually the cutoff that we use is in the range of 5.5 to 6 centimeter. But when you have chronic dissection, you're dealing much more than just with descending thoracic aneurysm. Very often you might have to, it will involve the distal arch. Thoracoabdominal aneurysm is probably very common as well, and sometimes you can even deal with isolated abdominal aneurysm. Chronic malperfusion does exist. It involves either chronic mesenteric ischemic symptoms or renovascular hypertension and even claudication. It is a bit different in acute malperfusion, however. It is not as common as in patient with acute dissection. The pathophysiology tends to be a tad different. I think there is less dynamic obstruction and more static obstruction of the branch vessel. Some organ or limb perfusions are completely false lumen dependent, and you have to remember that when it's time to do a TVAR, and it is nearly always associated with aneurysm. The surgical options that we considered, open repair, we still do a lot of thoracoabdominal aortic replacement. It's still a very fun operation to do. Open aortic fenestration, I would say, is not quite as commonly done as in the old days before we did not have TVAR. For endovascular repair, we do TVAR. We consider doing percutaneous aortic fenestration as well in certain situations. And in other situations, we've started to use fenestrated or branched EVAR to reconstruct patients with chronic dissection and thoracoabdominal aneurysm. Very commonly, you have to mix both. You have to do hybrid repairs where you will do a proximal TVAR, possibly with an open distal aortic replacement, or vice versa, where you will do visceral debranching first and then finish with the TVAR. I think all in all, the way you decide amongst all those surgical options is that you have to tailor the therapy to really minimize the physiologic impact of what you're doing on the patient that's in front of you. And I think that's probably one of the most key things to consider. And that's why when I deal with those patients, there are a few preoperative considerations that I have, some that are patient-related, some that are directly aortic-related. And for the patient-related consideration, age, obviously, the comorbidities, if the patient had a prior sternotomy or prior thoracotomy, will also sort of modify the way we're going to consider taking care of these patients. Cardiac and coronary status, pulmonary and renal function. For aortic-related, there are patients with chronic dissection that we're dealing with. It's from a type A, not from a type B. The arch involvement, the visceral vessel involvement. If a patient has Marfan or any other CTDs, the fixation zones needs to be really considered carefully. And if the patient had a prior TVAR, which is not unusual for us to be referred a patient that had a previous TVAR done, the easy part was done, and now we have to deal with the more difficult redo part. I would say that in general, these are the guidelines that I use. Young patients and those with CTDs are best treated by open repair, whereas older patients or those with significant comorbidities tend to be selected for a more endovascular approach. Preoperative planning is essential. I think imaging is essential. You need excellent CTA. We do also head CT and circle of Willis studies in a lot of patients. We do carotid and visceral duplex as well. And the patient preparation is important. Very often we have to hold anticoagulation because they've had a previous valve replacement. We hold Plavix. We hydrate the patients. We make sure that we optimize their lungs and their myocardium as well. Open thoracoabdominal aortic replacement is still a fun operation to do. It's not going away yet. We still do it by the classic posterolateral thoracotomy with medial visceral rotation. We try to spare the diaphragm as much as possible. We do the Creech reimplantation technique with visceral patch reimplantation. We use MEPs to monitor the cord. We do selective intercostal revascularization. We use CSF drainage routinely. We will use distal aortic perfusion and partial left heart bypass on selective patients. Here's an example of a patient that we do not do visceral patch reimplantation. This is a 33-year-old patient of mine with Marfan, and we did branch-to-branch revascularization for each of the visceral vessels. And you can see here that we also have a branch that goes to an intercostal patch in a different vessel. The left renal artery was simply reimplanted on the side here. Open aortic fenestration is something that we do not do as often. This is a review that we did back at the Mayo Clinic where we had done aortic fenestration open in about 4% of about 320 procedures for aortic dissection. However, if you do open aortic fenestration in those chronic patients where you need to resect, do the paravisceral aortic fenestration, they tend to do well and tolerate that very well. And those patients are very often, we do that to free up all the paravisceral segment, and we do usually neurobiliac replacement distally. This is an example of a patient with paravisceral aortic fenestration with neurobiliac replacement for chronic malperfusion. This patient was 58 years of age, chronic type B. He had a maximum diameter in the thoracic aorta of 3.2 centimeters, so that does not need to be replaced, but he did have a 6-centimeter AAA and chronic mesenteric ischemia with a loss of about 40 pounds, and he had right leg claudication. The right iliac had occluded from dissection years previously. And this is how we dealt with this, this patient. We did a long aortotomy all the way up to above the celiac, and we did resect the septum completely to reperfuse the mesenteric vessel and the renals, and we replaced that with an otobiliac graft. And this is a CT scan at a year. You see that the rest of his thoracic aorta remains with a chronic type B that actually has not enlarged over the years, but we've taken care of his large AAA and his chronic malperfusion. This is another patient with a chronic type B dissection. You can see that it's a bit of a problem because there's an aberrant right subclavian artery with an expanding symptomatic thoracoabdominal aortic aneurysm. Here's the picture of the aberrant right subclavian artery that is also dissected. You see the very large anterior tear here past the subclavian artery, and you see that the SMA and the right renal artery are coming from the true lumen, and the left renal artery here comes from the false lumen. So this is the kind of patient that when you are going to do a TVAR for this, if that's what you think about, you'll have to be very concerned about left renal artery perfusion. So the plan for this patient was to first create a proximal landing zone. That's often what you have to do in chronic dissection. We did bilateral subclavian to carotid transposition, and we were planning to do a zone 1 TVAR deployment. We also plan to do a retrograde embolization of the left subclavian artery. Very often in those patients, when you see the subclavian artery in a type 3 arch being really pushed on the other side of the chest, you will likely be not able to ligate the subclavian artery proximally, and we just do it by retrograde embolization. We were also planning to do a distal TVAR component with a tapered graft because of how small the true lumen was distally. We also were planning to do percutaneous fenestration to reconnect that left renal artery back into the true lumen system, and also to do kissing iliac stent to restore the left iliac perfusion. This is a pre-TVAR deployment angiogram, as you see here, and this is after the post-TVAR deployment, and you can see that the graft is in good position. We do have an endoleak here. That endoleak is a type 2 endoleak from the left subclavian artery. This is the proof of that here. So we have a retrograde brachial approach here, showing that we do have a large type 2 endoleak from the left subclavian artery. We take care of this by putting an implantable plug and embolizing it. And this is the completion arch angiogram. So we have a great seal at this level. All the flow is directed into the thoracic endograph. You see one of the transposition here. The other transposition is here. This patient happened to be, which is a rare thing, patient had a common cephalic trunk where both carotids come off of a common trunk of the ascending aorta. The left renal malperfusion was induced by this TVAR, and we had to do a percutaneous fenestration, and you can see that we use a Pioneer catheter here under ultrasound guidance to get into the false lumen, and you can see the wire going into the false lumen here. And this is essential to know that technique when you do a TVAR for chronic dissection, because that TVAR will induce in some patients the malperfusion of the kidney. And that patient was then treated. We did we passed the balloon into the fenestration system. That left kidney was then reconnected through that fenestration to true lumen with an ICAS. And in that way, you reperfuse the left kidney, but you also prevent flow into the false lumen in that paravisceral segment. And this is the completion angiogram of that patient with basically flow back in the true lumen. We completed that with the Kissing Iliac Stent at the bottom here. Now, when we look at the aims of TVAR for chronic dissection, it's a little bit the same and at the same time a tad different from acute dissection. We always need to cover the primary anterior tear. I think there's no doubt about that. You want to treat or prevent rupture, and if you do that, you're going to have to extend all the way down to the celiac. You want to reestablish organ or limb malperfusion. You want to cover the distal reentry tear as well as much as possible. You want to induce false lumen thrombosis, and I will say that the last one there is probably the most elusive of our goal, and promote aortic remodeling. This is a patient of mine that actually had a large proximal descending thoracic aneurysm from a chronic type B dissection. I did the TVAR. 2 years later, the remodeling in a proximal half of the thoracic aorta was phenomenal. It's all healed up. There is nothing left there. But you can see that there's multiple complex reentry system in the paravisceral segment that has basically caused the persistent of some false lumen patency at this level, and actually at 4 year post TVAR, it all went from 4 to 6.5 centimeter. So it's now time for stage two, and very often this is what happens in those patients. That's why surveillance is essential, because you will need in a lot of those patients to reintervene further. So the points that I've learned by doing TVARs for chronic dissection: the proximal landing zone is much more likely to require arch vessel procedures, because the worst part of the aortic dilatation is usually very proximal. That's where the DPDT is the highest. The proximal part will dilate the most, and it causes you to, in an acute dissection, you don't always have to even cover the left subclavian artery. In a chronic dissection, you very often will have to move the left subclavian and actually even also the left common carotid out of the way to be able to get a landing zone. Graft sizing is similar. We do not oversize for acute. We do not oversize for chronic dissection. It's one of the main risk factors for retrograde dissection. The septum tends to be thicker, so the percutaneous fenestration may be harder to do. The true lumen may remain compressed, and I think you're much more likely to use tapered graft as well. The false lumen is more likely to remain patent because the reentries have been well established and are more chronic. Graft tapering more likely to be needed. Extensive aortic coverage is needed. We always go all the way down to the diaphragm, down to the celiac for those patients. And distal malperfusion may be induced by the TVAR, and you have to remember that. And usually a good preoperative reading of the CT scan will tell you in which patient it will happen. Occasionally, we do direct false lumen interventions after a TVAR. And this is a patient that had, you can see the TVAR is done, looks beautiful. However, look at the amount of retrograde perfusion of that false lumen. It was going all the way up. If you treat a patient with a ruptured, for example, you really cannot tolerate that, and you'll need to obliterate this. And that patient, we did an iliac occluder at that level to occlude the false lumen, and this is the one-year CT scan. You can see there's still a little bit of false lumen from a reentry in a paravisceral segment, but there's nothing going up there, so you have an entire positive remodeling of the thoracic aorta. Other technique that have been used is to use covered stent. Whenever you get into a branch, if you do iliac stenting, if you do renal stenting, if you use a covered stent, you might prevent reentry in that near that branch as well. The Knickerbocker technique has been described up in Europe. I've not used that yet. Endovascular options, fenestrated or branched EVAR, the technical challenges that the true lumen tends to be narrow, and it makes it a little bit more difficult to navigate into the different branches. So for that reason, I think fenestrated graft tends to be preferred over branch graft, unless you use endo branches, which is also a technique that I've started to use with back table modification. Branch vessels can originate from the false lumen, and it also will complicate your fenestrated graft because you'll have to try to go find that branch and reconnect it to the FIVAR. And landing zones also can be inexistent, and you'll need to be created. Now, stage hybrid repair, this is something we often do also in some patients. If you do a proximal TVAR from the subclavian to the celiac artery, then you can follow it, and having, instead of dealing with a type 2 thoracoabdominal aneurysm, you're doing with a type 4 thoracoabdominal aneurysm, and you can then do a standard thoracoabdominal repair. We also do stage hybrid repair with visceral debranching. This is actually a Marfan patient of mine. But you can see that in Marfan, you can't TVAR the patient unless you've created a landing zone. This was a landing zone that was created distally by doing an infrarenal graft replacement followed by visceral debranching, and then we can put the TVAR into it, and this is the one-year CT scan. Of note, the patient also had a previous elephant trunk place, so we did have a proper Dacron landing zone proximally and distally in this patient. Spinal cord ischemia is a big deal in chronic dissection patients, and we clearly have those defined indications for CSF drainage. And I think it's important to really do that prophylactically and not wait for the cord ischemia to occur. So in summary, I think TVAR for chronic aortic dissection is feasible, is relatively safe, and offers reduced morbidity and mortality compared to the classic open treatment in well-selected patients. Surveillance is essential because you will have lesser remodeling and a higher need for reintervention. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to entertain any of your questions.
Any questions from the audience? Yeah, I think Jason wants to add a comment.
Yeah, thanks, John. That was a wonderful summary. You know, I'm always challenged with the chronic dissections that have large false lumen aneurysm in the thoracic portion. And so I agree with the idea that you start somewhere in the arch as close to where the entry with multiple sort of debranching procedures in the neck and then down to the celiac. Many times there are still chronic fenestrations in the infrarenal aorta or in the juxtarenal aorta that I think still provide retrograde perfusion of the false lumen. Give us some guidelines as to how you sort of approach, you know, do you just go down to the celiac and wait and see? And what's that wait and see time period? Is it a couple of months to see how it remodels? Or how aggressive should we be about trying to plug the bottom feeders, I guess?
I guess it all depends on how wide the paravisceral aorta is. I think the paravisceral aorta is very wide to just do a simple TVAR. And if you're already at 6.5 centimeters in the paravisceral segment, it's not going to work. You'll have to do more. But if it's only the proximal descending thoracic aorta, and if you cover the primary aortic tear, despite some of the smaller reentries distally, and a lot of patients will remodel positively. If you are lucky enough to have a patient that you have that you can identify a single reentry tear more distally, it's really worth chasing. And there are patients that you can actually just do iliac stenting, for example, and cover. They only have a single reentry. It's an iliac reentry. And you cover that, then you're going to have complete false lumen thrombosis from top to bottom. The majority of patients will have multiple paravisceral reentries, and those you really cannot chase in, you know, by simply doing a TVAR. I think you can do a false lumen obliteration by putting a either coil or cuffs there and block it that way. And eventually, if the paravisceral segment obliterate, then that's when you need to go to either hybrid technique or FIVAR technique. But it is clearly the most frustrating part of doing TVAR for chronic dissection.
Wonderful talk, John. My question relates to size. We use the aortic size index, which is based on body surface area. Obviously, small little women with a 5.5 centimeter aneurysm in association with dissection is a lot different than a larger person with the same problem. So do you use 5.5 as your cutoff for all patients?
No, I think I would probably use 6 centimeter for, I would say, a lot of patients. If a patient has connective tissue disorders, I use a smaller diameter, 5, 5.5. But I agree. There's no doubt that small female patients, 5.5 is probably a better cutoff. Obviously, it also depends of how much of an intervention you need to do and what kind of risk it is to the patients. So I think the size is really not absolute, and you have to gauge it according to the how much of an operation you need to do and what kind of comorbidities and life expectancy the patient has.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.